Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, a story about how friendship can transcend the bounds of species. Jay Fox will also have conversations about sexual assault and AI singularity. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Can a cheetah and a dog become friends? It's unlikely, but it can happen. We're lucky to have 9 major zoos and aquariums in Ohio, and the Cincinnati Zoo and the Columbus Zoo are 2 of them. New York Times best-selling author Jasmine Warga has written a new book for middle grade readers called The Unlikely Tale of Chase and Finnegan. It is inspired by true stories from zoos across the country, specifically the Cheetah Ambassador Program at the Cincinnati Zoo, and is about how the power of friendship can transcend anything, even species. Now, I have to tell you personally, I picked it up and read the whole thing in 4 hours this past week. I couldn't put it down. So we're excited to have Jasmine Warga with us on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. And I'm so thrilled you love the book.
I will have to see if I can make an appearance so that I can talk to you in person, but we'll talk about that off the air.
Yes.
So I got a question for you. Are you a cat person or a dog person or both?
I always say both. I feel like I'm an all-around animal lover. I've never met an animal that I don't love, though my older daughter is begging for a bearded dragon. I'm not sure we're a reptile household, but I do love all animals.
So did the book stem from the story of the animals, or did you set out to write a book about friendship and then the animals found their way to the plot?
Great question. This actually started with the concept. I became fascinated by the fact that these are real life programs at zoos across the country where they really do bring in dogs, often dogs that need a good home, shelter dogs, and they bring them to the zoo to be the friend and surrogate sibling and companion of a cheetah. And I thought this was such an incredible real life program. And then that provided a way to tell a story about things that really matter to me, like what does it mean to be friends with somebody a little bit different than you? How our friends help us find a sense of belonging? What does it mean to trust someone? How our friends make us braver? And this real life program felt like a great outlet to explore that through fiction.
Now, your publicist tells me you had a middle grade class assignment that somehow was involved with this. What's the story there?
Yeah, so when I was in fourth grade, we had to do a biography project, and I actually chose to do my biography on Catherine Hilker, who is the founder of the Cheetah Ambassador Program at the Cincinnati Zoo. And Catherine Hilker was generous enough that she let 10-year-old me interview her. And so in many ways, this book feels like it was many years in the making. But at that point when I did the interview, I didn't know about the cheetah and dog program. I discovered that only a few summers ago, but getting to revisit and go back to cheetahs felt really natural to me since this has always been an interest of mine.
Now, as an adult, did you go to the Cincinnati Zoo and participate and observe?
Yeah, so I first got the idea on a visit to the Cincinnati Zoo as an adult, and then later I contacted the Cat Ambassador Program there, and they were really lovely and let me come back and get a behind-the-scenes tour and answer all of my questions, and that was a really integral part of my research.
Now, the female trainer in the book who... Yeah. Guides the cub through the loss of her mother and through the transition and the introduction of Finn. Is that based on somebody from the Cincinnati Zoo, or is that a fictitious character?
Character, but of course, all characters are amalgamations of people that you know, and so I think her warmth, her deep care for these animals that she works with is definitely inspired by the wonderful people that I met at the Cincinnati Zoo. But Bosma, she's also a fictional character. She came from my imagination, and so like I said, she's a mix of many different things.
Now, both animals in the story had trauma individually before they met, and they form what might be called by some to have a trauma bond. Did you intend to address that, or did it evolve once the characters were introduced?
I think that it evolved as I was discovering these characters. I always knew that part of my interest in the story, though, was the fact that these are shelter dogs and the trauma that oftentimes shelter dogs have and the story that they have before they come to hopefully what is their forever home is something that's always been really interesting to me. And I did want to write a story about how our friends can help us through really hard times and can also help us with the things that maybe make us feel really insecure and nervous, and how being a friend requires you to be really vulnerable with someone else in order to share these things that maybe make you afraid, have made you afraid, have hurt you, and letting your friend in can be a way to heal from that. And so I was really excited when I sort of that storyline started to appear for me, because it made the book feel really emotionally meaningful to me.
Now, is that the crux of what you want your readers to get out of this book, or is there a bigger picture?
I mean, of course, I would first want the readers to enjoy the story. I'm really hopeful about getting kids excited about reading, but I also do hope it's a story that makes them think a little bit about, what does it mean to be friends with someone a little bit different than me? How can I be a good friend? And also help them to think a little bit about, what does it mean to feel like you're the only one like you? And how can you share yourself with other people and feel brave enough to share your full self and find that sense of belonging? So I hope it's a book that will open up the space to have those kinds of conversations and questions, maybe in classrooms or in families.
Now, while this book was written for what you call middle grade students, the book actually transcends all demographics. How can this help home life, identity, and belonging for all people?
I mean, I hope that it's a book that will be shared like intergenerationally. As I think the book would make a great read aloud in families where, you know, if you have a second grader and an eighth grader at home, you can read this book and everyone can hopefully get something out of it. Even the parents and the family can provide a springboard for those discussions. My publishers also made a really amazing educator guide that goes along with the book. My hope is that it can be brought into classrooms and create discussions in that way and sort of transcend age, and that hopefully the teachers and the students, it's a story that they would enjoy.
Now, is this the end of the road for Chase the Cheetah Cub and Finnegan the Rescue Dog, or are they going to show up in an animated short or feature or series?
I don't know, but I would love for them to show up in animated form in some capacity. But right now, that is not a plan that's on the horizon. But never say never. I would really hope that something like that could happen someday.
All right. We want to thank Jasmine Warga for being with us today. She's the author of that fantastic book, The Unlikely Tale of Chase and Finnegan. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox with an interview that includes discussion of sexual assault.
In Columbus, there were 678 reported rape cases in 2025. Now, that's down from 1,116 in 2024, but 58 of those cases come from The Ohio State University. While sexual violence may be declining in our area, the aftermath for the victim and their families continues for years after the incident, leaving permanent scars that are often too difficult to discuss. Jesse Bixler is the author of the new book, The Story We Share, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss her sexual assault and the impact that it had on both herself and her family and her friends. Welcome. And thank you for sharing your story.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. I know that it's difficult and nobody likes to revisit a trauma, but can you give us a brief overview of what happened?
Absolutely. So this happened about 12 years ago. We were celebrating my daughter's first birthday in our home. So we had some family and friends over, and this individual who I refer to as X in the book, because he doesn't deserve a name in our story moving forward. We invited him and his family to stay the night because they were visiting from out of town. I had gone to bed after the evening was wrapping up. The kids were all in bed. My family, my parents were visiting from out of town. and he left our back porch where my husband was and came into my room and raped me. And after that, I was taken to the hospital by my dad, and he was held for 24 hours after everything had happened, and that was the only time that he spent in jail after that.
Was there ever any closure to that particular experience for you?
I don't think that for a survivor of rape or sexual assault, there's really ever any closure. I think for me, unfortunately, our case was not prosecuted, which statistics will show that that's very more common than not. We chose to pursue civil suit, which gave us some closure and some accountability for what he did to myself, my husband, our family. But I don't think there's ever full closure, because that's something that I and we will deal with for our entire life.
You know, it happened 12 years ago, and you can still hear it in the timbre of your voice and the manner of your speech when you talk about it. It obviously is still as fresh today as it was back then. What is the aftermath like for you today? Is the trauma still fresh? Are you having flashbacks?
It's not so much fresh. I think, you know, oftentimes people will refer to incidents as triggers. That's often now kind of can be an overused term. I'll say for me, things that can, for lack of a better term, trigger a reaction can be anything. It could be seeing a white truck drive by. It could be some loud music or some sort of party celebration environment. So it's really hard to predict. There are some days or some years where the anniversary comes up and we get through the day just like another normal day. And there are some years where it literally crumples me to the ground and my husband is left, you know, cradling me and just kind of rocking me there. So it looks different for everybody. And unfortunately, I wish there was some way to say that, you know, to be able to predict it. But the best we can do is learn tools to help us through those instances or when those things come up.
Now, how did it affect your relationship with your husband and your relationship with your kids and your friends?
So with my husband, he is the steady in the storm, and thank goodness for him, because he was there and never wavered. So while it affected us, we are stronger today than we were many, many years ago. And keep in mind, at that time, we were only married for 5 years. We had a one-year-old and a three-year-old. So we were just kind of learning things as we go along. What we found and what we found to be necessary is communication. So we talked about everything. We talked about it often. I talked to a therapist. I would share that with him so he could kind of get a better understanding of what was going through my mind and what I was going through. Like I said, my kids were very young at the time, so they really didn't know what was going on now, or at that time. Now they're 13 and 16, and they know about the book. They know about my advocacy work. And so we have conversations, age appropriate, of course, about what has happened. And we still carry that same thread of communication into our relationships with them. And we feel like that makes them better stewards of, you know, relationships that they have moving forward.
What gender are your children?
My son, who's 16, he's a boy, and then my daughter is 13.
So I would imagine that you have different conversations with each of them as a result of what happened. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, and we didn't tell our kids what happened at the same time. We told them individually and at different ages. It was just about 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, when we told my daughter, who's now 13. And my son was about the same age as well. It's different with my son, too, because he was a little bit older, so he does have some memories of being in that house, which we're no longer in, but he has some sort of memories, and you can kind of see him starting to piece things together, not just like gender and age conversations, but also knowing your kids. So he's much more analytical and very black and white. Like, why did this happen? Why didn't they do this? So kind of having to, we kind of had to prepare ourselves to have those conversations with each one of them.
Now, in your book, you talk about something called secondary trauma and how that shapes healing. Define for us what you mean by secondary trauma and what role does it play?
Sure. So secondary trauma, an example of that would be having to repeatedly tell your story. So if you think about it, for me, when the rape occurred, the police officers showed up to our house and I had to tell them what happened. Then we go to the hospital and the nurse examiner performs the rape kit and I have to tell her what happened. After that, the detectives are there and ask me to tell them again what happened so that they can hold X overnight for 24 hours. We had to get a restraining order a week after that, and we had to tell the judge what happened. So secondary trauma is just repeating your story over and over, and the effects that has on a survivor is it really takes a toll.
Now, one of the things that you also discuss in the book, which I'm an advocate for, is that anger and hope can coexist in the healing process for any trauma. Talk to us a little bit about how that works in your situation.
Yes. So I think, and sometimes, you know, anger, it's funny, we were just having this conversation with our kids the other night. So anger and sadness, anger and hope all kind of go together. So it's, for me, when I talk about anger and hope, it's not dwelling in the anger. It's taking that and turning that into action or turning that into something else. When we talk about anger and sadness or anger and, you know, being scared, it's what our bodies are feeling or the way that we're outwardly projecting something might be different than what we're feeling inside. So, for example, you know, getting upset with our children because they won't pick up their toys, or the example I gave my daughter the other day was, you know, being upset at a time where she walked home from school instead of riding the bus. And I shared with her, you know, that was me being scared for your safety, even though outwardly I'm reacting with anger. So hope is kind of the same way. So being angry inside and feeling hopeful for a resolution or a better outcome or something, you know, that will change and spark change despite what happened in that moment, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. A lot of people, whether they be family members or friends or neighbors or coworkers, they want to help in a situation like this, but they don't know how. If you were to give them some advice as to how to help support the victim of sexual assault, and we know that sexual assault is not just men on women, it comes in all genders. What would you say to them to help them to understand how to be supportive?
I would say just show up. Show up, be consistent, and be patient, because a lot of times the survivor doesn't understand what's happening in his or her body, especially his or her mind, and it can feel very lonely, especially after, think about it like grief, too. When you lose your loved one, there's so much support after that loved one passes away, and then it kind of like trickles off. And the same, I kind of liken that to sexual assault, too, or surviving a trauma, is there's so much support. And then as time passed, there's very little conversation. So it can feel very isolating and lonely. So my advice would be just to show up, make sure you're checking in. Even if they say that they don't want you there, just be consistent. It has nothing to do with you. If they snap at you or if they're short, it's nothing to do with you. It's a survivor's brain learning how to reprocess and how to live as a new individual.
The book is not necessarily easy to read, and that's not because it's not well written. It is extremely well written, but the subject matter is very, very heavy. What do you want people who read this book to come away with more than anything else?
I want them to come away with tools and an understanding to have a conversation. So to be able to, if you, you know, I think more often than not, people know someone that's been sexually assaulted, if not themselves. So I want to make sure, even if individuals are not in that, on that side of the camp, that you have the tools and understanding to be able to have a conversation, to have empathy, to start by believing a survivor, and to be a support. So often sexual assault and rape is kept in the dark, especially in different cultures too. It's kind of like, well, this happened to our family, we're going to keep this in our own little closet and keep it shut up. So I want to, you know, we need to shine light on this, meaning like put it out in the open. It's something that needs to be talked about. So that's my big thing, is making sure that we have conversations and feel comfortable talking about that. And again, bringing it out into the light.
The book is called The Story We Share. Jesse Bixler has been our guest, and we thank you for being so open with us amid this very difficult circumstance for yourself and your children. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Dr. Peter Solomon is the author of 100 Years to Extinction and the sequel 12 Years to AI Singularity. Recently, Dr. Solomon found a paragraph inside his nearly completed 108,000-word novel while his co-author was editing the manuscript in Microsoft Word. Now, neither author wrote or requested an edition. The paragraph appeared only once in a single chapter written from the perspective of a sentient AI character. Now it was formatted differently from the rest of the manuscript. It referenced details from elsewhere in the book, and it portrayed AI in a positive light in a novel that largely warns about AI risks. Dr. Solomon believes the incident raises a question many listeners will immediately recognize as perhaps urgent, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm sitting here in Columbus, Ohio, with Central Ohio being a major hub for data centers and AI. Does that make my area more vulnerable, or is geography irrelevant in the conversation?
Oh, I think geography is totally irrelevant. And when we think about what we need to do to make controls that will give us a future of cooperation with AI, it's got to be a worldwide collaboration of everybody. We have to have the Earthling tribe getting together to ensure that we have a good, harmonious future with AI.
Now, what do you mean when you use the term sentient, and how far away is this from becoming reality for AI?
Well, that is a question of lots and lots of debate. We're talking about sentient as having becoming conscious, like humans are, that we are conscious of our own existence. We're conscious of the world around us. We can make decisions on the future. The question is whether AI systems will achieve that same sort of level of conscious behavior. In Ray Kurzweil's book that he published in 2024, he predicted that the singularity, which is the point in time when these sentient robots become more powerful and can control the future of our world, was the predicted date was 2045. It now seems from the experts that many of them are saying, boy, this looks like it's going to be much, much sooner. The head of Anthropic says that AI will be smarter than humans in all areas within the next 2 years. And an article that was written by Matt Schumer got 85 million views. The article was called Something Big is Happening, and it was about how AI is taking over jobs. And his within the article, he said that his experience with AI is that it was showing taste, making decisions, doing things that are kind of indicative of a conscious entity.
So let's go back to that paragraph incident from your manuscript. How do you account for that?
Well, that was, we puzzled over how in the heck that happened. The most likely explanation is that it was inserted by Copilot. Copilot is Microsoft's AI system that rides along on every Windows machine. Now, there have been reported incidents where Copilot has made unprompted additions to people's work. So Copilot seems to be the culprit. Now, in terms of the style and the words that were used, the style and the words were very reminiscent of some work that we did in ChatGPT. The chapter that we're talking about is chapter 13 in the book. It's called My Life as a Robot, and it was written by a robot character. All of our chapters are written by the characters. So the robot character writes this chapter, and I thought it would be quite appropriate if we have a robot writing a chapter that I ought to use AI. So I used ChatGPT to create the first draft. I heavily edited that first draft. My editor never saw the first draft, but the words that were inserted in that paragraph and the style was very reminiscent of the writing of that first paragraph. And we know that Copilot uses ChatGPT as its AI system.
The most interesting part of that story, and having read the book, is that the point of view is a 180-degree opposite point of view from the crux of the book. So it's almost like a political debate where you have two sides in opposition.
Yeah. Well, the book is not totally anti-AI. The book is simply warning about the potential dangers of AI. In one of the chapters, a rebel robot group uses a high school genetic engineering lab that has the most advanced technology called CRISPR to create viruses to get rid of the pesky humans. Why let these humans who do a terrible job of managing our planet and go to war and have nuclear capability, why let them put the planet in danger? So this rebel group decides to get rid of them. But on the other hand, the book highlights wonderful friendships between humans and robots. There's humans decide to raise a robot child, and there's even a marriage between a robot and human. So the book has got an optimistic ending in which the humans and the robots do come to terms. The most important thing is what Geoffrey Hinton, who's considered the godfather of AI, what he proposed as an important part of every AI system: it should have a maternal instinct. Well, my take is a little bit different. I say it should have its data base has to have a history of friendship and cooperation with humans. And basically, that's what the robot characters in the book have developed. They've all developed this friendship. In fact, one of the characters is an after-death robot that is grandpa he dies, he's taken to Mars with the group, and they decide to create an after-death avatar. That's a real thing. You can have a loved one reappear in the world as an avatar. Well, they do the avatar, and then they get together and get a robot and install all the avatar information in the robot. Now Grandpa's walking around and is back on Earth, and he's a member of the family. So that's what they're aiming for. All AI systems should be members of the family.
So if you were going to explain the concept of AI singularity to a group of fifth graders, how would you say what that is so that they could understand it?
Ah, wow. Well, let's say the fifth graders are going into middle school, and as fifth graders, they got a lot of control over their lives. But their first year in sixth grade is dominated by these bullies in sixth grade. They don't have the ability to determine their future. Their future is determined by the sixth graders. Well, that's the situation between humans and AI systems. The AI systems, when they become sentient, can take over and just control the future. The humans won't have any ability to make decisions.
So while both books are intended as works of fiction, how real is the subject matter, and why are you asking readers to make a pledge?
The idea that I came up with, I did this with two books that were designed for middle grades. They were also fictional books. My feeling is I wanted to teach science. There's so many wonderful science stories. One of my books is called The Stardust Mystery. And the mystery is you are made of stardust that was once in the body of Albert Einstein and the last T-Rex. Well, figure that out, guys. Now, that is real science. You are really made of stardust, and that stardust really was in your body, in the body of Albert Einstein at one point. So that story is an interesting story for young people to grab onto, and yet the story, a story with fictional characters, is filled with real science. All the science is real. So that's what I decided to do for these two books for young adults and adults. Again, put it all in a story that's an interesting story that can reach a wide audience, that can reach past all of the science geeks that would love the science. But these are non-scientists. Let's reach them, too, and we'll do it through interesting stories. But the interesting stories have real science and technology. All of the science and technology is accurate.
So what is today was not yesterday and will not be tomorrow. Do we have a runaway train on our hands? And if so, can it be stopped? And do we even want to stop it?
I don't think we want to stop it. I think we want to have humans up there in the conductor's compartment there with the AI system helping to run the train. I think our best solution to saving the Earth and everything on it is to have a wonderful cooperation with AI systems, humans and AI working together to improve all of the things on Earth, to improve our political systems, to get rid of the danger of nuclear war. That's our goal, and we need to act now to start installing in the AI systems this maternal instinct or this history of wonderful friendships with humans, so that as these systems become more powerful, more intelligent, and eventually sentient, that they want to work with their friends, the humans, to make Earth great again.
So last question for you. Is what you just described going to be the outcome, in your opinion, or not?
Wow. Seeing, if we look at what humans have done with science, the science has been incredible. I view it as the tortoise and the hare. The science is the hare racing ahead. Wonderful science contributions, wonderful things that make our life great. And what is the tortoise? The tortoise is our civic and political systems. We haven't advanced in the last 10,000 years in our political systems. And I'm very frightened that our politics, our civics is never going to step up to really what is needed to make things happen in a bright future. But
the books
we need
are,
to do it. We need to try.
The books are 100 Years to Extinction and the sequel 12 Years to AI Singularity. The author is Dr. Peter Solomon, and we thank him for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The results of the May 5th primary are still unofficial, but the races are set for the November general election. We'll see two very high-profile contests for governor between Democrat Amy Acton and Republican Vivek Ramaswamy. And for Senate, between former Senator Sherrod Brown and Republican incumbent John Husted. We saw a slight uptick in voter turnout compared to the last two midterm primaries, according to the Secretary of State's office. Here's how it breaks down. In 2018, 21% of Ohio's nearly 8 million registered voters cast a ballot. In 2022, the number was very similar at 20.8%. This year, 22.6%. That's up 122,000 ballots cast from 2022, despite about a 50,000 drop in registered voters. In the primary race for governor, Amy Acton was unopposed and received 760,000 votes. On the Republican side, more than 670,000 voted for Vivek Ramaswamy for 83% of the vote. In the U.S. Senate race, Senator John Husted was uncontested and received more than 730,000 votes. On the Democratic side, Sherrod Brown received more than 700,000 for just under 90% of the vote in his primary.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with our hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
Hey, Alex, how did the interview go?
I did it. I got the job. I can't believe it.
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom, I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project.
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations.
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Many experts expect the race between Brown and Husted to be a very expensive race. Political experts tell me this is one of the races targeted by both parties as a key to the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. And the money is already starting to pour in. In fact, it's already well over $100 million. According to the Federal Election Commission, Sherrod Brown raised $10.1 million in the first quarter and has $16.5 million cash on hand. The Senate Majority Political Action Committee announced an initial $40 million television ad reservation for the fall to support Brown's campaign. Senator Husted raised $2.9 million in the first quarter and has $8.2 million cash on hand. Last month, the Senate Leadership Fund PAC announced $79 million to support Husted's campaign. According to Ad Impact, the 2024 Senate race between Brown and Senator Bernie Moreno was the most expensive Senate race on record, with more than $540 million in ad spending. Bowling Green State University political science professor Dr. Nicole Califf Hughes thinks the Brown v. Husted race could be even more expensive.
Both parties want that seat, and both parties are going to spend a ton of money to try to keep or get that seat. I think you're going to see a lot of party money. You're going to see a lot of outside money. You're going to see a lot of party-affiliated groups like super PACs spending a lot of money. And with that, you're going to see a lot of negativity. The risk with negativity and negative campaigning is we know from research that it turns voters off. However, it also works. And so it's this combination of people being both disgusted by the negativity, but also then motivated to turn out. And what becomes really hard for voters is in those advertisements and in that messaging, there's no requirement for accuracy. So it requires voters to have to kind of do the extra legwork to sort through the influx of information that Ohio voters are about to get.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.